History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. If we only ask a few questions and invest just a little bit of time to listen, boy, we are amazed by what we end up hearing. Our goal here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you've noticed a bit of a pattern in 2024. We've had a series of 80th anniversaries. The D-Day anniversary received the most attention, but we've tried to shine a little spotlight on what was happening in the Pacific, too. We've had the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Saipan, and then Guam, and we're going to spend some time on another 80th anniversary this week before wrapping up with a significant situation that came a little bit later on, but also connects to the battle that we're spotlighting today. All of the island hopping the Allies did in the Pacific was part of the bigger picture that saw World War II finally come to an end. And certainly every American life that became part of the price of freedom is worthy of remembrance. If you've ever been to the Marianas, you know that less than 3.5 miles north of Saipan lie the 50 square miles of volcanic land known as Tinian, an island that would come to play an extremely significant role in the conclusion of World War II. 80 years ago this week, the men of the 2nd Marine Division and the 4th Marine Division were celebrating the liberation of that island from Japanese control. In comparison with the fights for neighboring islands, the Battle of Tinian wasn't nearly as long, only 8 days, and not nearly as costly in terms of casualties. More on that in a moment. But the Battle of Tinian would add a footnote in history in marking the first time one particular weapon was used, and securing that island paved the way for a truly world-changing weapon to be deployed about a year later. I mentioned casualties, and between the troops ashore and at sea in the Battle of Tinian, only 377 Americans were recorded killed or missing. Imperial Japan would lose almost 6,000 there. The number of Americans wounded in the Battle of Tinian was just about 1,700, and we get to hear the stories behind two of those Marines' Purple Hearts today. In both cases, the injuries they sustained were significant. They were both fortunate to survive. More than 1,500 of those Purple Hearts were earned on the island itself, while another 177 were wounded at sea as American ships engaged the enemy. Aboard the battleship USS Colorado, a Pearl Harbor survivor named Elmer Wright was part of the Marine Gunnery Detachment.
On Tinian now down there, when we come back to Guam, we fired star shells. A lot of Japanese swimming from Saipan over Tinian. We kept that going all night long. But some Japanese officers convinced our officers that there wasn't very many troops on Tinian, but he was wrong. But 2nd, 4th Marines, I don't think they had any trouble at all on the other side of the island.
Right, but the side you're on, and this is late July 1944, you're on the USS Colorado. You've already participated in the bombardment of Saipan and Guam, and now you're at Tinian, famous, of course, as the launching point for the Enola Gay a year later. But as you're helping to capture this island in July of 1944, you are working on your gun emplacement, other guys blasting away with theirs, but you are a little closer to shore than usual, and your ship received some serious damage there.
Our ship got hit. I don't know why we was in there so close. Well, the machine gun fire, you could see it flash up out of this buck brush and stuff. We were firing machine guns there. We could have got out there 5 miles away from the island and with those heavy guns and battered that out. Yeah, there's a big battery in the way up on the ridge, come out of a cave, a tunnel. And we supposed to made a, troops made a fake landing on the side. We was on the north side, and the 4th and 2nd Marines is on the other side. We supposed to draw the enemy to our side, but we did all right. And there was 7 barges there, and they sunk every one of those. Our ship had just sat there close, just go around. Starboard side all fire, then the port side. I don't know why the skipper kept doing that. Instead of trying to get away from them, get out of the line of fire, we could have been out there 10 miles still bummed that all.
And you were on a 20-millimeter the whole time?
Yeah, we had, the 7 of us got killed on that group. We had 3 guns there, 10 men there. I can name most of them. Platoon Sergeant Bunch, he was laying there on the gun tub. He was laying there at the end, something coming over his throat, so he was dead. And on the gun I was on there, we had 3 men to a gun, and I had Narboard. We had one guy hanging in the harness. He got killed. He was laying there in the harness, still the gun sticking up in there. Then Narboard come down. He fell right on his stomach right in front of me. I was standing there, and I got pretty bad in my leg and back wounded. And Private Glass come and fell right over the top of him. He was mumbling something to me. I never could figure out what he was saying, but and I seen blood come out of his mouth, and he gulped, and he died. And there was Sabinski at the other end, Corporal Sabinski. He had his whole leg shot off, and he was standing up on that one leg praying, and still alive, and there was a couple of corpsmen come up there. They bandaged my leg up, put a tourniquet around it and everything. And I said that I told him to take care of Sabinski first, and all we can't help him. Later on, they load us in stretchers. They'd load us down stretchers to the main deck. It was set up about 12, 14 feet below the main deck. Give me a good shot of morphine and take me down to the Marine quarters there and laid me down. Most all them guys was dead in there, laying there. And I says, boy, this can't happen to me. I thought maybe they'd take me for dead because I passed out from morphine, I guess. And when I woke up, I was on a hospital ship. I don't even remember them taking me off the ship even. And on there, the funny thing is a Japanese corpsman. I thought I was on a Japanese ship there for a while. And I played like I wouldn't open my eyes. Finally, a Navy commander come in there, and he wanted to know I was in. The guy above me, he got stepped on the mine. Boy, his leg was that big around. He's a lieutenant. And so the commander talked to him. He said, try to keep him awake up there. Keep talking. He kept talking about the Keys College and all that. But he died that night. And we went on to New Caledonia, Mob 5 Naval Hospital there. And I was so bad, a couple guys come in to visit me that I was with on the ship there. They had minor injuries. One of them couldn't stand to even look at me. Now, I even attempted suicide. I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I got thinking, well, I'd take a sleeping pill. They'd put one up, put it on my pillow. I got about 7 or 8 of them. I saw them both, that knocked me out. And so finally, they pumped my stomach and come out. And the chaplain, he sat there and he talked me out of the suicide stuff. And I really didn't want to come home. I didn't want people to see me like things are.
Wow. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your candor. You went through things that most people never will, and certainly none of us wants to, but you're really making this real for us and helping us understand not just what you went through, but what so many others did, and even today, the things our men and women in uniform are dealing with. You were on a roll there, and I didn't want to interrupt, but I do want to go back a little bit now. Obviously, you were in need of repair and healing, but your ship was too. You were on the USS Colorado, and this big battleship is in close to shore to shell Tinian, but the Colorado ended up taking 22 hits itself during this time, damaged badly enough that the ship would have to go back to the West Coast for repairs after that. And the Japanese, it seems, had a lot more firepower on that island than your leaders expected.
When that big gun come out of that mountain, they had a tunnel all the way through that mountain, its own tracks. Boy, they sure laid it on us.
When you saw those big shells coming your way, was that happening for a while before you yourself got wounded? Did you have time to...
When they started, we got hit right off. Two shells hit right amongst us, sir.
And what happened to you? Where did you get hit? What did it feel like? How did you react to that?
Well, I was on the... mostly Sabinski standing there on one leg to help him, but they put a terminal around my leg. Then when they left, I felt my coveralls on fire and put my hand out of cover with blood. That kind of bothered me a little bit. They couldn't put no tourniquet on my buttocks. So they finally got it and trapped me in that stretcher and lowered me down. And they gave me a lot of morphine. I passed out.
So a shell from that big 8-inch gun came in, just exploded, and you didn't know where you were hit.
No. I know my shoe was off my foot, but my leg and my back and injury, they never even checked my back. They put a tourniquet until they got the rest of the guys all the... They're taking the dead ones to last. They're still laying up in the tub.
Was there any part of you that wasn't sure you were going to survive?
Yeah, and the ammunition box got on fire, and we had these 5 buckets of sand for incinerator bombs. They burned right through the deck. So I picked that up. That was after I was wounded, too. And I threw that at and covered that tank. And I put the fire out. I got a bronze star for it. And on the other side of the Marine put out, he was a kind of a yard bird. Nobody liked him very much. And the colonel gave him a silver star. So I met this colonel out by Dobbins, California, a couple of years ago. And I asked him, how come I just get a bronze star? And the other guy got, oh, he saved more lives than you did. Yeah, there wasn't but three of them. Yeah, it was Jones and Oates and me. That was only three that lived on that. All the rest of them were killed.
Out of how many?
I think it's 11. Now, one of them was a Navy guy. He was an ensign. He was a kind of a lookout. Him and Platoon Sergeant Bunch. Oh, Early was the one that was hanging in the harness of my gun there. I was the loader. We taken turn about handling the machine gun.
But when you got hit, you were actually on your 20-millimeter mount firing toward the shore?
Well, I wasn't known. I was the loader.
So you're loading shells, and all of a sudden everything explodes around you.
Man, that stopped everything. Oh, yeah, Sergeant Seeley. He had a deal about this high, you know, around the kind of protection. He jumped over that and hit the deck and broke his hip, and I think he died later on because he wasn't in New Caledonia when we got there.
You kind of just matter-of-factly said, well, you got the bronze star, and I know the other guy got the silver star, but I want to touch on what you did here because it's significant. Here you are. You're wounded. You're bleeding from who knows how many places, and you see that this ammunition box is on fire. And I'm guessing the implication is there that if that fire goes unchecked, there's a whole lot of stuff. That
killed everything. Yeah, I threw that at it, put the fire, but they were just three of us all got saved there anyway.
But if
that fire had killed us all.
It would have exploded all these rounds of ammunition, and you all just would have been dead right there.
Yeah, they put some kind of coddling on these shells, but that fire was burning up about foot high there.
What made you think of this sand? How did you even get that idea?
Well, we had the buckets of sand sitting on for in case we got incendiary bombs could put it out. We had one up there, and I didn't know what to do. I seen it there, and I said, this is on the shell. I grabbed that, and I still was standing on one leg. But I threw the fire went out, and I threw it in on the fire. And 20 millimeter, once while we were firing, I changed that rifle, the barrel, and it was bent. It was firing, but no shells coming out of it, lodging up inside the barrel. So I changed that barrel, finally got it out, and it bent. It was so hot. But old Early, he was hanging in there. He was starting to be a lawyer. He's very educated. And he was the one that was doing the firing in that battle.
Well, you told us a little bit about your injuries and lying there and not knowing where you were. Then you woke up on a hospital ship. What kind of care did you receive, and how long did it take for you to recover from those wounds?
After we got aboard the hospital, he picked shrapnel out of my buttocks and on my spine right above my buttocks, two pieces went on each side of my spinal. I remember the doctor said, boy, it was close for you. But then he went on New Caledonia there, and I attempted that suicide. But man, I lost about 80 pounds. I looked like a skeleton. Now I told the chaplain to let my parents know that I was missing in action. He said he'd take care of it, but he didn't tell him that. But I finally pulled out of it, and we come back states another year and 9 months hospital. My first son was born there, and I was married there, and I didn't think I was going to ever get out. And I worked out 7 in a wheelchair part-time after I got out as a checker, you know, checking the box on and off, 3 o'clock in the morning. And 8 o'clock, I'd go over and go to school. I went to school for about 5 years. So finally, I bought a GI Bill of Rights house right where I lived there in Oakland.
A year and 9 months in the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital recovering from those crippling wounds. And he just casually mentioned that during that span, he got married and became a father. There's got to be a story there. So let's see if we can get it. Mr. Wright, how'd you pull that off?
Well, I met my wife when she was about 13. Her parents live in Oklahoma, and they went back there, and I got to riding to her, and her mother's taking care of her, make sure she didn't go out with other boys. And so she come down, and I heard on the loudspeaker, and I thought it was another girlfriend. But I went there, and I told her she didn't want to marry a crippled guy. I was going to send her back, but she wouldn't go back. So we come down to San Joaquin, where my folks live, and they stayed there about a week, and then went back down every week. So finally, we end up getting married.
It must have really meant something to you, or proven something to you, that this pretty girl wanted to marry you when you're all banged up and in a wheelchair in the hospital.
Yeah. Well, she stood behind the chair and we got married. We come down, we married down in San Joaquin. And so we was married 63 years, and she died here about 80 years old. She's awful young, she got married, she's just 16. But she had all this, her mother, they thought I was Lord Jesus Christ, I don't know. But they thought the world of me.
Well, and people say don't get married that young. It must have worked out right for you guys. I'm just thinking about your story, and here you could have been killed on that ship. You were handicapped, and even those pieces of shrapnel in your spines came oh so close to paralyzing you. How do you make sense of all these things that have happened to you and the fact that you're still here?
I don't know. It's a funny thing, but I don't think I ever got scared. I was thinking about safety more than anything, keep from getting killed. But we're taking some kind of pills, kind of helped along. They give to them Tawanetherolin. It helps you from getting upset or something.
They were using you guys as guinea pigs a little bit, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Do you feel like God was looking out for you?
Probably, yeah. I know I went to church several times on the ship there. After that, I don't know if it helped or not.
Any special story about receiving your Purple Heart and your Bronze Star? Did they make a big presentation out of that, or did you just get it in the mail, or what?
One Purple Heart I got in the mail. It's up there. I didn't think that's when I got hit in the arm. I thought it was maybe friendly fire. They gave me a Purple Heart for it. And the next one I got on Tinian. I was in the bed when they awarded that to me, bedfast.
You mentioned something about the chaplain sending word to your family. What did your family know this whole time, and what did it feel like when you got home and saw him again?
The first sergeant sent a telegram to it, critical. When we got to New Caledonia, thinking about suicide all the time. I didn't want people to see me like I was. I didn't even want to live. And so the chaplain, he sat there almost all night at my bedside. Then after that, they put guards, made sure every guy taking a pill.
Yeah.
But I was putting mine out of the pillow because that's the only way I could feel I could get rid of myself. But a person puts his mind to something so strong, you can do it.
Well, and I guess now you're probably pretty thankful for that chaplain, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I look back and sit there all night, too.
Well, I guess we ought to be thankful for that chaplain, too, because without his sitting there all night with Elmer Wright, we wouldn't have heard that story. Part of the human cost of liberating the island of Tinian from Japanese control 80 years ago this week. When we come back, another Marine wounded at Tinian who happened to witness the first time in history one particular weapon was deployed. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode honoring those who fought to liberate the island of Tinian in the Marianas 80 years ago this week. Among the more than 1,500 Americans wounded on those 50 square miles of volcanic land throughout an 8-day clash was Bill Crumpacker of the 2nd Marine Division.
Well, we landed on Tinian July 24, I believe. And we were, the 2nd Marine Division was a reserve for the 4th Marine Division. The 4th Marine Division had been with us on Saipan. So we worked together. The We landed the evening of July the 24th. As reserve, we just got ashore and spent the first night laying off the beach a little. There wasn't any problems at all. And we didn't do much of anything for several days. But one thing I did note on Tinian, and I thought, the poor old infantryman, he's getting obliterated. But we had planes coming over from Saipan. Saipan's 4 miles from Tinian. We had Marine planes, Navy planes, Army planes coming over, bombing Tinian. We were sitting on a ridge there, still in reserve, and we saw a plane come in. He came down in a dive and dropped two or three bombs. They landed on a ridge. There was about 300 yards of fire. That was the first napalm bomb dropped in the Pacific War, I believe. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, my Lord. Because you could feel the heat. We could have been a half a mile or three quarters of a mile away, and you could feel this heat wave hit you. So you realize that even if the fire didn't get you, the lack of oxygen would get you. And the next day we moved through that area again, and there was a lot of enemy soldiers there, and the closest thing I could say is it looked like bacon out of the frying pan, the human body, what that napalm did to these fellows. And you had to feel sorry for them.
And you brought that up, and I've looked into that. That was the first time that a napalm bomb had ever been used by the Americans at war. And it makes me wonder if that was something completely new to you on the ground. Had you ever seen a weapon like that before? Did you know that it was in the arsenal? And was that a major shock to all of a sudden see that unleashed the way it was? And obviously the idea behind it is to get rid of some of the foliage, produce fewer areas where they can hide, and in the process it killed a lot of Japanese as well. But was that something that was a big shock to your guys' system to see this weapon deployed the way it was?
An absolute shock. Of course, I got discharged as a corporal, and the field brass really didn't come down and talk to the corporals too much about what they were going to give us in the next operation or anything. But this was unbelievable, I thought, because it could have lit up a quarter of a mile on this ridge. And I thought, boy, if any soldier around there is a goner. It was just unbelievable. And even on Saipan and Tinian, if you'd see one of our men come up with this fuel tank on his back and the flamethrower in his hands and turn the flamethrower on, you had to feel sorry for people on the other side. And I thought, boy, I hope I never see a Japanese flamethrower coming toward me. And that never happened. So Lady Luck and somebody was looking after me there. The day I got hit, we were still in reserve. We were on Tinian for 3 or 4 days. And as I say, we were reserved for the 4th Marine Division. They had made the initial landing. We were told we were going to go up and relieve another unit. I don't know whether it was 4th Division or it wasn't 2nd Marine Division. So as we were moving up, still hadn't been on the front lines, an artillery piece opened up on us. We tried to take cover because it was on a ridge up looking down on us and so on. Some of the fellas ran in a sugarcane field, and they dropped a couple bombs there and so on. And I heard someone holler, and it turned out to be a lieutenant. I found out later. He says, come on, we have to get over the ridge. So I looked around, and there was a bare piece of ground there that wasn't planted to anything. It was probably maybe 40 yards, 35, 40 yards in length leading up to this ridge. So I thought to myself, these guys in the sugarcane field are getting some artillery dropped in, and if I get up and run, I can get over the ridge because they aren't going to zero in on one man, I guess. So my thinking undid me on this one, because when I got up and started running, there were some other fellas that jumped up too and followed me. So it was like a covey of quail, I guess, running up through this bare ground. Well, they certainly dropped a shell in there, and it got me. My helmet went off. My head was ringing. I got hit in the head and the neck and the right arm, and I remember the corpsman came up, and he cut my pack off, and he said, "Is that you, Crummy?" And I says, "Yeah, I think so." And I told him, I said, "You better clear out there. If they're going to drop another one here, and here we are out in the open, and I'm going to have to dress his comment up a little," because he said, "Oh, those other fellas don't have very good vision. They couldn't hit the same spot twice if you bet on them." So a half track had spotted this artillery piece, the last shell it fired, and opened up and got it out of the way. So here I was in the field down in my Marine Corps active duty days were over that day.
And it sounds like your friend, the corpsman, injected a little humor to probably keep your mind off of the devastating wounds you'd suffered. But also, I don't want to gloss over this. You were basically telling him, "Let me stay here and die, save yourself, so you're not hit by artillery." But his job was to make sure that you were saved. And I imagine when you look back at that, that means a whole lot to you, that he cared more about saving you than, you know, potentially risking his own life in doing so.
Yeah, I guess thinking back on it, you know, I certainly didn't want to cash in my chips, but here I am on my back, and he's getting his pack out and all this and that, just going about business. And I said that to him. I said, "You know, they're going to drop another one in here." "Oh, Bill, blah, 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 blah." I thought, well, we'll go together, I guess. But he's an unbelievable guy. He was from New Jersey. I remember his name. His name was Richard Wallen, and I'm indebted to him terrifically.
And I know that from that point on, there are a lot of other people that had a hand in your recovery. How severe were your injuries? How debilitating were they? How long did it take you to recover? I know you've got the picture here, and if folks want to take a look, they can go to our website and see you in a hospital in New Caledonia with a full body cast and your arm sticking up in the air. You thought for a long time that you might lose your right arm. Is that correct?
Yes, and I would tell the doctor they would x-ray my arm from time to time, and you could surely see a gap between the shoulder joint and my upper right arm, and I'd comment to him, and he says, "Well, you know, you're still a young lad." He said, "We'll see if we get some regeneration there," and that actually happened. And I'm very thankful to the Navy Medical Corps because, and this is funny, when I was in a hospital at New Caledonia, the doctor was coming around and he'd say, "Well, can you write with your left hand?" I said, "Yeah, I can. I'm going to try." They say, "Okay," and, "Well, do the best you can." "Okay," and he'd leave. And I didn't say, "Doc, I've been left-handed all my life," because I didn't want the VA to know that. So I learned to write with my left hand.
So they must have thought you were incredibly ambidextrous at the time. How long did it take before you regained function? And I know you still have a hard time buying dress shirts because your right arm's a couple inches shorter than your left arm. You still have shrapnel in your neck. How long did it take you to regain function and to actually get up and be Bill again, be Crummy, as your friends called you?
September of 44, I got back to the States and was transported to the Oakland Naval Hospital, called it Oak Knoll in those days. So I am here in the cast, and I'd talk to the medical corps. I'd sure like to have a new cast. "Well, you aren't getting a new cast because the x-rays, everything's lined up perfectly. We aren't going to monkey with it." So that was September of 44. Almost a year later, the cast came off. And there was bone there, and so I've always regarded myself as being quite lucky. I didn't come home with any thought about, "Oh, look what happened to me in the Pacific." I came home with a very, very good outlook on life, And I had the GI Bill to turn to. When I got discharged in January of 46, I started college. And I didn't know how I was going to hook on with college and the books and taking notes and so on, but I managed it. And I've had a very good good life. I had a good wife, and she passed away. And there was several times in my life whether I would live to be 21 and cast a vote, but it turned out pretty well for me. I can't complain much at all. I taught school for 30 years and retired in 1982.
I do want to ask you, with regard to being a school teacher, with everything you went through in the service, and you described how your outlook coming back was one feeling fortunate just to be around and not complaining about what you had gone through. I imagine kids in your classroom probably couldn't get away with a whole lot of complaining because you had some stories that might top them. Did you ever have to pull on your Marine Corps experience to set them straight?
I don't believe I ever had a class where I went into the Marine Corps business. I figured the parents were paying me to teach them. I received a letter from a former student who was in Ketchikan, Alaska. Her mother had sent her this deal that was in the B. She was telling me that she felt very fortunate to have good teachers, and I was one of them. And she said, "Do you still only give half a Kleenex to students?" I might have told them in those days, "You're only half grown, so here's half a Kleenex."
Well, and that's a half a Kleenex more than you had on Tinian, probably.
Yes, yes, it was.
When they say, "What was World War II all about? What were you Marines doing over there?" What's the best answer that you come up with in a situation like that?
Well, you really had no choice. If you're a citizen of the United States, you couldn't very well decide who's right and who's wrong. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. We didn't start the war. And even the A-bomb and the H-bomb and so on and so forth. That was a horrible weapon, too. But I was talking to someone one day, and I said, "Yeah, but," I said, "personally, what's a horrible weapon? If you get a bayonet in the stomach, that's a horrible weapon." So you really can't grade them. But when you talk about the Marine Corps, it's just unbelievable. My wife always accused me of being horribly biased in favor of the Marine Corps. I said, "You just don't understand it."
And perhaps only a once a Marine, always a Marine like the late Bill Krumpacker really could understand. It is time for our final break, but when we come back, more context on why putting Tinian under Allied control would end up making such a difference in World War II, and the connection to another anniversary solemnly observed this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode marking 80 years since the liberation of Tinian in the Mariana Islands. We've heard from two Marines who almost made the ultimate sacrifice in that eight-day battle. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that most people who have heard the name Tinian have come across it in the context of the atomic bomb and the fact that the Enola Gay and Boxcar took off for Hiroshima and Nagasaki from Tinian for their historic missions that would hasten the end of World War II. But the Enola Gay wouldn't have an atomic bomb to drop without the cruiser USS Indianapolis, which is the topic I'd like to devote the rest of our time together to today. This past Tuesday, July 30th, in Indianapolis, Indiana, the 9th annual USS Indianapolis Honor Watch began at sunrise and lasted into the afternoon. It was the 79th anniversary of the sinking of the ship that delivered components of the atomic bomb to the island of Tinian. And families of the 879 men lost at sea, in addition to survivor families, members and honorary survivors and friends gathered to remember the greatest loss of life on a combatant ship at sea during World War II. I've told you before about fantastic books written about the Indianapolis tragedy, and we've heard from some of those 316 survivors. If you have never watched Sarah Vladek's award-winning documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy, I don't think I've come across anything that helps you truly grasp and feel the situation any more powerfully than that does. And it is on all your streaming platforms. Just Google USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. 79 years ago this weekend, the survivors of the Indy were being rescued, and that includes the lone survivor who is still with us in 2024. He celebrated his 97th birthday in June, and you can now find a beautiful statue of him in Benicia, California. Harold Bray was the youngest sailor aboard the Indy for its final fateful voyage. Typically, you would sleep below deck, but because it was so hot, they told you you can sleep topside?
Yeah. That's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right. I took my shoes off and my clothes on. And when about midnight, a little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off of that, I was like a 10-foot drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I see my shoes go over the side, and I was dressed with dungarees on and sleeping on the open like that. And I got down on the quarter deck, and it was just amazing. We carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarter deck when I got down there. And they were starting to bail off. We were still on our way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarter deck. I got down on the quarter deck, and guys were going nuts. They were running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding. Some guys. I stopped at the quarter deck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to. I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of a pocket. And I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad. And I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side. We were on the Fantail, so she was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one. And all that time, she was keeling over. And by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side. And instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarter deck instead of floating off the Fantail. I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarter deck, and that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water, and I could see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. But I hit the service, and when I come to the surface. I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already, and the guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled, and I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on a, we had a raft. So we picked up, I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft. And so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side. But other than that, it was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
A couple of things I want to ask you about there. One, do I understand correctly that that was the very first night you were sleeping topside?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my deck was three decks down, next to sick bay. My bunk was here. There was a stack of three bunks, and I was on top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So.
And isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And decided to sleep up on top of a steel deck rather than in my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladeck and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where is it going to go? Where is it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit, but she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down, and you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves, with no escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves. And that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. We didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No, we're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned.
Yeah, my whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, but it was all on my left side. But that salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
But it burns, you know, until it scabbed over, and it was a couple of days. And the salt water was no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity, too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned. You're covered in oil. You have no food, no water?
No, no. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun, because we were oil from head to toe, in eyes and mouth, tongue, still taste it to this day.
Oof.
It was, you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, that, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached,
Right, yeah. Floating
there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. I don't know how many guys, we ended up with 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Oh, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. If you're on the outer edge of this group, I think we counted off the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pecaut life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. There were flash burns, weren't deep burns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old, you're burned, you're covered in oil, no food, no water, and now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple of times. One got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But the face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. But it was pretty scary because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait as well.
Well, and sharks weren't the only reason that guys died. Can you give us some other examples of what you saw happening that prevented some of those other sailors from surviving?
Well, the burns, some guys were really burned pretty bad. And then, of course, drinking that salt water, go crazy. And they never taught us anything in boot camp about that, you know. Of course, I was out of boot camp a couple of months before I got on a ship. They never talked about, because she just got back from the war zone, and she just repaired. She was taken pretty hard at Okinawa. She took a couple good hits there. That's when I got on her, when she got back from there. Then we went right back out there and got hit again.
So some of the guys around you, even on your raft, because you had no fresh water,
no,
and you're getting pounded by the sun while it's up, some guys resorted to drinking that salt water.
Oh, yeah.
And then they'd have hallucinations and maybe just go under or swim to some vision.
A lot of the guys just attack other guys, you know, they went crazy. And I just had enough sense to stay away from them. I don't know what made me do this, but I stayed by myself most of the time. Matter of fact, I swam away from the group and got a raft by myself for one day. And then I start picking up survivors and They were just hanging on to each other.
As I just imagine, and it's really impossible for us to imagine going through this, because except for you guys, no one's gone through something this insane. But I would imagine that initially, the first night, the first couple days maybe even, there's a fair amount of hope that someone's going to find you guys?
Yeah, everybody, I don't know if we had any radio guys in our group or not, but they got a radio message off, but never was one, I don't think. We had airplanes go over every day, and they were way too high. And the last day in the water, I was looking to the horizon and seeing this airplane just come, like it just came up like this out of the horizon and came right at us. And it wasn't looking for us. Flew right over us, and then we was screaming and splashing in the water, and they saw us, give us the wing thing. And he came back and did it again, and I'd seen him go straight up, and that's when he radioed what he had. And, of course, it was another day and a half before we got rescued, but we knew somebody knew where we were. But other than that, nobody knew where we got hit. Then they took us off the board in the Philippines, thinking they were already in there. We're supposed to report in, but I guess somebody messed up and took us off the board and didn't know where we were. Just a stroke of luck that we ever discovered. He just seen us by accident. He wasn't even looking for us.
What did you say to him the first time you got to meet him?
I think I kissed him. I don't know.
Is there any doubt in your mind whether or not you'd be alive if he didn't see you?
Because we were in the water 4 days already. Nobody saw us. If they did, they ignored us. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was, when we first hit the water, there was like 1,100 of us in the water. If you were hurt, you weren't lasting. But it just died off every day. We were burying guys. And it was not a good sight to even think about, you know. It was quite an experience.
The plane comes over, so you know you've been spotted. But then it's another day and a half before they come back.
Yeah.
Seems like that might be the longest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It was, where are they? Where are they? They're never here. Where are they? Of course, we were like 200 miles off of land, any land. So a ship, even traveling at 6 knots, takes a while to cover 200 miles. And at one point, there were 6 ships. Came to the rescue, and the Bassett was the one I got on. She was the first one there. And see, when I got picked up, I was by myself. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. We were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? With everything that you'd been through, when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett, and you know for the first time you're actually going to live, what did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us. I don't think he was high enough to see us, but he seen the oil slick. We were in the oil, and that's how we got discovered.
He thought maybe he'd find a Japanese submarine to shoot at or something.
I guess that was what he said,
Was there ever a point in those 5 days where you thought about giving up?
I practically did. I was getting tired. Of course, there was more room on the raft by that time. You know, it was not a raft. It was a rope.
A rope net that you could get on top of and sit.
But you're still in the water up to your neck, holding your head up.
But you don't have to actively hold on with your arms anymore.
You're hanging on to each other until everybody was gone, you know. Just lucky. Just the guys that lived through it was just lucky.
And boy, are we blessed to still have Harold Bray with us 79 years after the tragic sinking of the USS Indianapolis. It wasn't until he was in the hospital recovering from that ordeal that he learned what the secret cargo was that the Indy had carried to the island of Tinian, as he and the rest of the world learned about the atomic bomb. You can link to Harold Bray's complete original interview, as well as longer conversations with the two Purple Heart Marines we heard from today, at hometownheroesradio.com. But that's all the time we have for now. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.